Hello and welcome to the Astra Economic Week in Review. My name is John Eckstein. I'm Chief Investment Officer at Astra Investment Management. We're joined today by Claudia Somm. Claudia is a longtime Fed staffer. She's the founder at Stay at Home Macro Consulting and a senior fellow at the Jane Family Institute. And you also have do some work with the Institute of New Economic Thinking.
Yeah, that's right. And I also get to write now for the New York Times opinion and Bloomberg opinion. So I stay busy.
You're in the Bloomberg. You're in the Bloomberg stable. The Bloomberg stable, economic stable, is quite good. So yeah. we'll definitely get to read you there. Claudia has actually done a lot of work I admire very much, trying to make economics safer for women to inhabit in a full way. And I'm very grateful that you're doing that work, Claudia. So thanks for that.
Well, thank you.
I know it's been a little stressful sometimes. So
yeah.
So we usually start off with a little bit of a capsule of the economy. I see us as coming out of a little bit of a period of stagnation, maybe since September, October, the recovery had gone to sort of low gear, and I may be seeing some green shoots the last couple of weeks. Like, how does that reconcile with your view of the economy where we are right now?
Yeah, so I absolutely see green shoots. I also see a light at the end of the tunnel. And for the first time in this crisis, I feel like that light is not a train. Like it's for real. This was something we would joke about it with during the financial crisis. You know, if you're not laughing, you're crying. So, yep. But I feel like this time, like there's daylight out there. We are not out in it, right? We are not safe.
No.
One of my biggest concerns about this latest relief package, and it's not the inflation, right? It is that we might be pushing ourselves out into the world, back into routines faster than is safe. I am feeling safer. The vaccines are coming out. We are making progress in the right direction. It's not time for us to let down our guard. And we're going to put a lot of money in people's pockets, and people are going to be ready to get back to work, get out shopping. So we do need to be mindful until we really are in a safe place, but we're going to get there. So I'm very encouraged. And, you know, you asked about, like, if we think about the arc over the past year, you know, we're talking today on March 11th, and this really is an important day to reflect on. This was the day COVID was declared a pandemic. This was the day President Trump spoke from the Oval Office, like the NBA shut down, right? Like, this is the day it got serious. I had the opportunity. I spoke that morning to the House Democratic Caucus at their minority whip breakfast. Jason Furman and I stood up there and were like, you have got to go big and go broad and go really fast. And 2 weeks later, CARES passed. I knew we were in a very bad place. We were in free fall. We were watching it in markets seizing up. We were watching people losing jobs. So it was clear that we were in a very bad place. I, for having been a person who studied the effects of fiscal policy on the economy for, you know, well over a decade, was really impressed. CARES was a huge package. It touched so many people that needed money.
It was fast.
Yeah. And then we saw the labor market start to crank it, right? Like people were getting back. And I mean, I was as surprised as many experts how fast people were coming back. Now, to your point, like things did stall out as we got into the summer and the fall. And frankly, the problem was when CARES passed, and I disagreed with this view, but when CARES passed, it was like, oh, we're going to be shut down for 4 weeks, 6 weeks. You know, we'll reopen, we'll have COVID under control. And so by the summer, we're going to be back to normal, right? And so the package was written that way. And so like extra jobless benefits is $600 a week. They expired at the end of July.
Yep.
We heard a lot of talk, especially from Republicans. Oh, let's wait and see. Things are getting better. And what happened, and I think, you know, from past experience, this is not surprising. Things stalled out. Right. And we were making progress, but it was a real grind. And then, you know, towards the end of the year.
Now you're talking about late summer, early.
Late summer of 2020 and getting into the fall. And we were still down, you know, well over 10 million jobs. Like we were halfway out of the hole, but it was a huge hole. And then the worst of our nightmares came true as we went into winter. COVID came back and just hit even harder than the spring. We saw a relief package pass in December. That was an absolute nail biter because, again, there were a lot of jobless benefits that would expire. We had a lot of people that didn't have a happy holiday, and that helped. But then what Congress has done, Congress enacted the relief package. President Biden will sign it tomorrow. And this is another $2 trillion. It comes off of nearly $4 trillion last year. We have not seen spending like this since the Great Depression, the New Deal. And like, it's going to matter. So I'm excited, but we are still, and we get jobless claims. There are still over 20 million people that are relying on that money from the federal government, from state programs every week. We're 9.5 million jobs short. Like there's a lot when you look at the economy that's pretty frightening, and yet there are signs of hope.
I agree with all of that. And let's just go through, you said this is Thursday the 11th, Thursday, March 11th. I just wanna touch on the numbers that came out in the last week. We'll start with the labor market. So the initial claims came out about unchanged when you add up the pandemic unemployment insurance and the regular state claims. That's about unchanged. The headline was down a little, but I don't see that as strong improvement. You pointed out that there's 20 million people on, as of 2 weeks ago, there were 20 million people on one form or another of jobless claims. And that there's only, but we're only 10 million jobs in only, but we're 10 million jobs below level non-farm payrolls. How do you square that?
Yeah, so not to get too much into the weeds, but one should be very careful. All right, this is a weedy show. There are many reasons why you can't compare one-to-one jobless benefits with jobs missing.
Yeah.
Some of it's just, you know, these state programs, they're not there to, you know, collect official statistics. Right. They're there to get benefits out. And we do know since the beginning of this crisis, the state unemployment agencies have been like just crushed. And we're still getting hundreds of thousands of new claims every week. Like
there was 1.1 million new claims. 1.2 million new claims this past year.
Yeah. So every week, and I'm actually in two different unemployment insurance group DMs on Twitter. Like these are like real experts. There's very few PhD economists in it. So that tells you just how smart they all are about policy.
Elizabeth Panicotti's in there, right?
Oh, yes. Yes, yes. She's in both of them. Anyway, so the smaller one almost operates as like group therapy in addition to exchanging information. There's just every week it's like, oh, this state had a reporting error. We have tragically had some of these jobless benefit programs targeted by, you know, rings of criminals that are getting benefits
in someone else's name.
Like, this is a problem. It's not like... This isn't like people finally claim they didn't really lose their job, right? One by one. This is an attack on a system that's overwhelmed. So like, you got to be careful with those numbers. Now, when you talk about how many payroll employment jobs are we missing, how many workers are unemployed, like those come from the Bureau of Labor Statistics. They are official statistics. There have been some problems measuring the unemployment rate, but these are statisticians who are
that's a misclassification.
Like that's their job. To get a picture of what's going on, you really have to think and follow conditions broader than the numbers we would usually rely on, right? Yep. And so in the unemployment rate, the Federal Reserve a couple weeks ago, Chair Jay Powell was giving a speech, and he said, in their opinion, just looking at the national unemployment rate, which normally is like the statistic you want to understand, are we in good times or bad? They said, well, we've had millions of people in a very unprecedented way just leave the labor force.
Right.
And in some cases, it's parents who need to take care of children who aren't able to go to, you know, daycare or to school. In other cases, it's people in high-risk groups. There's been millions of people leave the labor market. If you take them into account and you say, you know, they're unemployed, really, like they would be working if it hadn't been for COVID, or they would have been like looking for jobs, then the unemployment rate is more like 10%.
Right.
than 6%, right? So I think it's been important for us to really be honest about the fact that many of our the information we'd normally use to set policy or to even talk about what the need is out there, they're not quite what they usually are, but it's also not that hard.
Right. Yeah, you can definitely make,
right? Like, you know,
you can definitely make some adjustments.
Yeah, and just talk to some people, right? Like this has been a really bad year. So, but again, you know, claims where the numbers are in the hundreds of thousands of people claiming, this is but we've seen millions for, you know, a long time. And in March, it was absolutely crushing. We would have 3 million people. It was just
I've been watching these
incomprehensible.
Numbers. I've been watching numbers for 30 years and like I didn't even know what to think. So, you know, you do bring up Powell. We've got next week where they're going to, you know, one of the quarterly meetings where they release new projections. What about a Fed preview? What do you see next week? Do you see any changes in the Fed stance?
No, they're not changing anything. The one thing that is, I don't know, amusing. I mean, I love the Fed. I follow everything. So my what I call amusing and fun might not fit many other people's definition. But one thing, if you follow the Fed, you know that the Fed does not like to surprise anyone.
That's definitely not their job.
This is not the way they approach their job. And so the Fed meetings, if something's going to change, we have heard about it for weeks.
Yeah.
Right. Like they plant the seeds, they look at the reaction. Right. So what I expect
speech here, a leak there.
What we've heard, and this is consistent for now Fed meetings past too, is very public statements by Jay Powell, by Rich Clarida, like by a lot of senior officials at the Fed saying, we need to get those jobs back.
Yeah.
We need a recovery for all. The Fed has spoken more bluntly about marginalized communities, Black and brown workers.
I've never heard anything like that.
When I worked, so I started at the Fed in the summer of 2007. Huh. My first forecast, and I was a lead on consumer spending, was in January of 2008. You know, we worked together as a team. No one was going to let me fail, but I mean, they were like, good job, you know, birth by fire. And then I was on consumer spending through the whole recovery, which was like really the most painful. Like 2011 was the hardest time for me on the forecast because we kept saying it was going to get better. The Fed wasn't like V-shaped recovery, get better, but like we missed over and over again. And I followed consumers and I just knew like we were being too optimistic and we weren't doing enough. But in that whole time I was at the Fed on the forecast, that was about 10 years, I never heard race discussed. Like we chose the national unemployment rate. And like, if you know labor markets, like it's, you know, the Black unemployment rate is much higher, young adults, right? Like you know these things and they're kind of like always. So in some ways we didn't need to talk about it. And yet given how hard these communities were being hit and particularly the subprime crisis was in like a lot of the, we didn't talk about it. And like even in my whole time at the Fed, which I left at the end of 2019 and I worked in a group at the end in the Division of Consumer and Community Affairs, it is like low and moderate income people. This is what we focus on. And like, I never heard the word racism in the building. And when I see the words and the speech and the actions, there is so much more awareness of the economic injustice that is in our economy. Now, the Fed doesn't have like the best tools to fight this.
Right.
But they do have some tools and
they've got tools that can make it worse, even if they can't make it better.
And they have a mandate, right? Yeah, so since employment. The late 19th, Congress told them
to make full employment.
Yeah. And I think, so again, I'm one of these total Fed nerds. And so I have, and I love history. Like this was part of my introduction to economics, like was to think about institutions and economic history when I was an undergraduate. And so I started reading about the Fed, about its history. It had its 100-year anniversary while I was there. So, you know, I was egged on by all of these, you know, documents and, you know, meetings and things. And one of the things, so the Fed got its dual mandate in 1977, and that told them, you need to, and this Congress told them, yep, your job is to keep prices stable. So, you know, keep it up with inflation. You know, high inflation is bad. And you need to get us to maximum employment.
As someone who's been watching the Fed since 1990, like, they always would talk about full employment, but you kind of got the sense they didn't really mean it.
Yeah, yeah. And they, and it, what's interesting is that dual mandate came directly out of the civil rights movement. The March on Washington was for jobs and justice, right? And so, and Martin Luther King Jr.'s widow, Coretta Scott King, was standing at the signing of legislation in 1978 that created what's called the Humphrey Hawkins hearing. So twice a year, the Fed has to go before Congress and tell them, what are we doing? How are we doing relative to the mandate? So they started the, you know, after 1978, they did this in the early 80s. Paul Volcker, who had like just cranked up interest rates to like 20% to bring inflation down, he was before this hearing and they rightly asked him, hey, unemployment is double digits now. You know, you got two mandates. And he, and this was a very consistent refrain from the Fed for like decades, the best we can do on unemployment is to keep inflation low.
Right.
Right. So they like totally defined away their mandate. So, you know, fast forward all the way to the present, what we have seen in this past year, and this was building, like the Fed had done a framework review. They were learning from how painfully slow the recovery was and how much they had been wrong about how many people could come back to work or would want to, right? Yeah. So now we hear the Fed, like they're always going to care about inflation, right? This is part of their job. And like, this is like hardwired in Fed thinking. They are a central bank. We are very unique as central banks to have a dual mandate, right? But what we hear now is a very explicit, we need to get people back to work, get them back safely. And we are going to keep pushing until we can get as absolute close. And they have, in an unprecedented way, said, we're going to let inflation go above our target. I mean, they haven't gotten
to that. That's one of the things.
Inflation. But that's like very new. And when you watch financial markets, bless their hearts, there's like way too much for them to wrap their head around right now, because you have this massive fiscal policy effort, which we haven't seen since the New Deal. And none of them were around, like we ain't that old. Right. And then we have a Fed that has suddenly woken up and is like, oh, we have two mandates. And so between these two, and I mean, frankly, if you are a wealthy investor, inflation is not your friend, right? It's borrowers, you know, if wages and prices rise at a good clip, but not like really, really high. Nobody likes that. It's actually cheaper to pay your debt back. But then if you've been a lender, you don't get as much in terms of what you can buy. Inflation is bad. And yet if you ask people, and I've worked a lot with household surveys, not having a job and a paycheck, that's really bad. Right. You know, so the Fed has a balancing act. It's been very encouraging. Both the Fed and Congress and the administration, they're kind of all rowing in the same direction. Now, the Fed is not political. Like, it is so unusual what they're doing now, going to Congress and saying, do more, do more. They stepped in 2008 when, after Congress said, yeah, let financial markets go, the Fed's like, oh, wait a second, we have these emergency powers. We're going to step in. So when they feel like they have to, they will get into the politics. I mean, in the crosshairs, right? Like, they're not picking sides. They've done this past year, and it's a dangerous space for the Fed, and they don't like to be in it. And I imagine now that we've had a packet, they're going to like step out of it quietly and kind of focus on their thing more quietly. Right. But long story short, like, they have made very public statements. The Fed takes its credibility very seriously, and it's going to keep trying to message to Wall Street, like, we're serious about this. Like, really, really, right, we are. But these are words right now. Like, these will be tested as we get into this year. I do expect inflation, and the Fed does too, to start coming up.
Yeah,
I mean, the data we got this week, the inflation is really low. Right. So it is coming up next month, you know.
Right. Next month and next month and next month. So Jay Powell probably asked about the fiscal policy. So he's going to start trying to not answer those questions. He's also going to be asked about inflation, I guess maybe not this time because inflation was low. And he's going to be asked about rates. Like, do you see the Fed trying to work on the long end of the curve? Rates have come up, you know, 70 basis points in the last couple months. That's kind of a lot. Do you see the Fed being more or less happy with that because that's because real rates have gone up? Or what do you see the Fed doing on the long end of the curve?
Yeah, so I really feel like the Fed is steady as she goes right now. Yeah. And they have already had to deal with a lot of inflation hawk squawking. It's pretty impressive how unified they have gotten the Federal Reserve officials. I mean, you usually have some Federal Reserve Bank official who's like going rogue at any particular moment.
Some president.
Discipline that Jay Powell has been able to institute. And there have been times where people kind of wander off the script and like they bring them back in real fast. And yeah. So I think that unified front, because they know they're doing something different, they have to have a unified front. They all agreed, the Fed officials last year, it was announced, but they all agreed to a new framework. Like yep. This maximum employment, right? So they're just, they are carrying out a plan that they spent a lot of time thinking about. And they, one of the things that became clear, this was in the winter in particular when things got worse. The Fed was very clear, like we're in a bad place. The vaccines are coming. Like it was kind of a temporary, yep. really bad place. And the Fed said, you know, we don't have tools for a temporary problem because interest rates, like they could, they will never do it, but they could take interest rates really negative, like bring them down. And this would not move spending a lot. Like even before the crisis, if you weren't borrowing, if you weren't investing, it was not really because rates were high. Like rates have been low and going lower for decades. So all the Fed can do is push down. They don't control, but they can push them down, put some downward pressure on interest rates. And frankly, at this, and that works slowly through the economy. Right. And this was why the Fed kept going to Congress and saying, you have to do more. It didn't tell them how big, what specifically to do. But like Congress has the power of the purse, unlike any institution in this country. And so they can get money out. What the Fed was arguing is like, we'll continue to keep interest rates low. Like, we're not going to try and undo what you're doing because we recognize more spending is needed, but you can't expect us to go this alone. And after the Great Recession, there were long periods where like the Fed was the fight against the recession and they just don't have the right tools. So I don't, like they're going to want to keep interest rates low. The tools they've been
using
have been effective.
For the long end, like bringing the long end down probably wouldn't help the recovery.
I don't think right now.
And so they'll probably just let the long end take care of itself.
Yeah, but they've brought, I mean, treasuries are really low, right? Yeah. The 10-year treasury. So I think what they've been doing is effective, right? They're doing asset purchases. They do a lot of forward guidance, which I have for years, like direct. I was like, Fed, you're going to use words to move like markets. Good luck. But they actually are getting a lot better at it. Jay Powell is really good about just, you know, cutting right to the message, which, you know, academics before Bernanke and Yellen is a little harder. And Volcker or Greenspan prized himself on being
obscure.
Unintelligible, right? Like, so they're actually getting, they're getting a real bang for their buck in terms of the policies that they're using. I don't think that they want to bring the 10-year down.
So for the 10-year, you were saying that you don't think the Fed's going to sort of let it take care of itself. If it wants to move it down, it's still buying a lot of securities. I guess it could buy a little bit more if it really wanted to, but it's probably not impeding the recovery at all. So they'll probably just let it be. Is that accurate?
Yeah, I mean, it's, they're putting downward pressure on it right now. I think they'll continue the policies that they've been using, like the asset purchases, like being very clear in their messaging that they are not going to raise rates until they have seen inflation consistently above their 2% target. The vice chair, Clarida, it's very unusual. They don't like to actually quantify things, but he said in a speech, like, we need to see inflation over 2% for a year.
Right.
Right. Now, all bets are off if it gets over three. Like, I mean, he didn't say that, but you get a quarter of 3% inflation, they're going to like start doing something, as they should, right? There are conditions in which the Fed should raise rates. And it could be before we hit 3.5% unemployment like we had before COVID, right? Like, the Fed always, they like to say, we are not on a preset course, right? Like, which is basically like, if the world changes, the Fed will change, right? Like, they know what, they know how to do their job, right? So, but they've put some really clear markers down, and they've gotten clear over time because the markets keep being like, nah, we don't believe you. And it's just, and then that'll push up this interest rate. I don't know. Like, the Fed is trying to do their job, and I think they're being pretty effective. Now, like I said, they'll change if the world changes. So they could do something different. And they've talked about other tools. The asset purchases is clearly something they feel comfortable with. There were speeches about yield curve control. So that's a little more of what you were getting at, the specific, you know, going out at different maturities, like the long rates. And the thing they will never, ever do is negative interest rates. Like, they have been so adamant internally and externally, but you know, there are tools out there and they'll keep going. But the Fed doesn't, just like they don't like to surprise markets, they don't like to do new untested stuff, right? The great recession, the financial crisis, they had to, like, in a moment where they have to do blue sky thinking and dream it up on the fly, but they don't like to. They hate every minute of it. And as soon as they can tell that a tool like these unconventional policies work, like the asset purchases, they're just going to ride this, right? Because they have now a feeling about how it works and why it works.
So when do they start tapering? If they're going to wait till 3% to hike rates, do they stop buying at 2% or?
Or
there's more of like a feeling, I'll know when we see it then, kind of end of the year. I guess I sort of end of the year penciled in as to stop.
So I don't expect us to be back towards like the labor market we had pre-COVID until into next year, like early.
Yeah, so that actually makes sense. I had a question I want to ask you in particular. Like, one, so do you think it's possible that we could be back to trend growth and have labor market, I don't know, 5 million jobs below where it was the beginning of 2020. Do you think that's a plausible scenario?
Yeah, so and the Fed has been clear about this too, and a lot of the inflation hawks have not. I would put all eyes on the labor market in terms of thinking about the economic conditions, like not GDP. Now, on the other side, like for their other mandate, you keep an eye on the inflation numbers. And the Fed looks at every different inflation measure under the sun, right? Like they are deep into those numbers. Yeah. But on the other side of the mandate, they just ignore GDP, right? Like first of all, we know from the past that like the initial numbers, they revise a lot. Right. So we don't even know where we're standing right now. After the first print for the change in GDP over the course of 2008 was a less than a 1% decline. And like the statistics now, after years of revision and getting more data, I mean, it's like 3% or something. I mean, it's huge, right? So like we didn't even realize like how bad the world was in early 2009 when they started doing stimulus.
Right.
So it's like whatever.
The errors are pro-cyclical, right? So that's like been a long.
Yeah. And you know, it could be different this time, but like swing for the fences, right? Like, cause
you think the Fed is going to be more focused on, cause I could definitely see like GDP back to trend. And,
we could see it.
And payrolls, you know, several million below where they could be. And you think the Fed's going to be more focused on payroll?
I think they're going to look at the labor market. I looked into this because this was over a month ago. Tim Dewey, who's another like really smart
podcast guest, former podcast guest.
Yeah, no, he's great. So he had one of his weekly newsletters out and it was talking about, well, compensation from employment. So like total dollars going to employees in this country was basically back. And this was third quarter. This is before. And now fourth quarter, it's like actually a little above where it was.
Back when his newsletter was still free.
COVID. And I was like, how does this work? Like, we're still down 10 million jobs. Are these people not earning anything? Like, so I went and the Bureau of Economic Analysis started publishing recently was called their a distribution of the personal income. Right, which this is amazing. We have so much more better data than we had in the Great Recession. I mean, these statistical agencies have totally been cranking it. Anyways, but what you can do in this data is look at total personal income. You can look at compensation too. That's by every decile. So like every 10% of households by household income. Right. And when I drew that chart, even I, who knew, like, I focus a lot on inequality, right? I do macro, but I think about inequality. I know those numbers, it adds up from people, right? Like, it's not, you know, just some GDP is out there. I was shocked. The bottom six deciles, so like 60% of households, and this is low and moderate income, I mean, we're getting up, have less compensation than the top 10%. The top 10% are not like the rest of us, right? Like even right. The next decile down is notably less. So I was like, oh, wow. And we know that of the 10 million jobs left, a lot of them are low-wage workers. So it's they really weren't earning anything before. And so, but if you have as a Fed, and we see this in Congress too, if you have decided I'm going to fight until we get those workers back in. And you don't get to maximum employment until you bring the ones on the margin in. The last people to get their jobs are in the most marginalized groups, and they don't have jobs right now.
Right.
Right. So like that's, but GDP compensation, it like, you just can't see it. Right. And so I think that's why you've heard the Fed move so much. And I definitely do this too. And I'm working very hard to draw some of the focus away from GDP, from aggregate income numbers. I mean, with, you know, moderate success, like the old guard in macro, like they just eat it up with GDP. And then they also really rely on what are called potential output estimates, which is basically like, well, how well can the economy do in terms of cranking out stuff? Like
how, those have been systematically too low for.
Well, they were low in the Great Recession. So I did some analysis to push back on Olivier Blanchard's, oh, we're lighting a fire. Yep. And he was doing this potential output arithmetic and was arguing that this latest rescue package is larger than the gap that the CBO like says we have or will have in potential output relative to GDP. And when old school models say that once GDP is higher than what the economy can comfortably do, then that would be an inflationary point. Like prices would have to go up. So supply meets demand. Okay. So, but what the exercise I did was like, okay, let me go back and find in 2010, what the CBO said in 2020, we could accomplish. And they've revised it down consistently since then. And you know what, if I use those numbers, the output gap is like twice the size of this $2 trillion, right? So it's like, okay, the world changes. And some people were like, oh, but does that just mean they're like always get it too high? And it's like, no. When you go back to the late 90s, when we had an investment boom and like tech and all this, they were consistently underestimated. Like potential kept revising it up.
Right. Because they were the economy. Because we would be growing faster and we wouldn't end up with inflation.
Yeah.
We were wrong.
Yeah. And so we could have a moment. And I think this is, I mean, I'm a big proponent of the rescue package. I'm a big proponent of what comes next in terms of an infrastructure package. I think particularly, and I hear this in a lot of members too, infrastructure is also about investing in people. It's not just about bridges and roads, right? And so if you do that and you do it well, like the devil's in the detail, but if you do it well, you can really crank on what this economy can do. But like, I do agree that like, if we pump trillions and trillions of dollars in the economy and we don't really raise taxes to take some back out, which I mean, I think we'll do some of that, then you could push the economy too hard. Like it is possible, but you know what? If you help the economy do more, if you help workers do more, well then, you know, like you get a twofer, right? Like you have made the economy more dynamic, get growth rates up, get productivity higher, and you've gotten us out of this mess faster.
Yeah.
But I don't have a crystal ball. They don't either. There are risks. We ought to talk about them. I don't like cast aspersions on the Republicans in Congress who said no to this. Like, they're the elected officials. I can see the other point of view. I disagree with it. You can trace it back to economic rationale. You can trace it back to political rationale too. But like, I'm economics. That's my lane.
It's not impossible that they're going to be right. And
yeah, it could happen.
I don't think
but you need to talk about the risks. And one of the things we always did at the Fed when we forecast is, you know, we'd have the staff forecast is the most likely path, like our view of what that is judgmentally. After looking at lots and lots of data and running a gazillion models, we would agree this is most likely. We would always have the exercise of what are the upside risks. Like, what's the best thing that could happen? And what are the downside risks? And we would think of as many as we thought was appropriate. And then we would have a conversation about which way are the risks weighted?
Yeah.
You know, so it's like, of the upside risks, are they more likely on balance than the downside risks? And I think what's in my professional opinion, and you definitely hear this from the Fed, which, you know, this is their framework, doing too little right now could be disastrous. And the risk of that is much higher than doing too much.
Yeah, so that makes sense. So we've taken up a lot of your time. I think I promised 20 minutes.
I'm a talker. It's not your fault.
And two questions I did really want to ask you
briefly.
The first is on inflation. I think everyone sees a spike in inflation this year as spending goes up and some things are still constrained. So do you see inflation as spiking and then going back to trend, or is spiking and staying relatively high, or do you not have an opinion on that?
Yeah, so I would be cautious about using the word spike.
Okay.
You know, it's true. If you watch inflation really carefully, you know, it moving up by a tenth of a percentage point or two. I mean, like, this would be like, oh, wow, this is so big, right? Like, I mean, so we will see movements that people like get really excited about. But even at the Fed, we wouldn't call a tenth or two tenths, especially how low we are right now, spiking. And I think we're going to see gradual. I do think it's entirely possible that later in this year, inflation will have gradually moved up to 2%, maybe a little over 2%.
Yeah.
I don't see that being like ongoing. Like, I don't see us getting a year of that. And frankly, I see the chances of 3% inflation as really low. Right.
But you know,
things will change if it gets really high, and it would change if it spiked. Right. Like this is, and these are things that could happen. I think we just have to remember, and I really, the hawks just, I don't know what planet they live on, but like $2 trillion of spending, we have a $20 trillion economy. Yes, this is a lot of spending. And yet, like, you are not going to like send a $20 trillion economy over the cliff with this. And if we see infrastructure next, and there'll almost certainly be some tax increases to have some pay fors, like,
and infrastructure can't come until
and it's going to be slow, and it's going to
be reconciled. It can't come to the fall,
and it ought to bring some more can do to the economy online.
Right. So, and it'll be spread out over 4 years, something like that. Like,
yeah. And then we have the other thing is we have a global economy that is depressed. We are of the large economies, and this is true in Europe too. Like, we are the ones that are vaccinating at a speed that is like way fast. Like, thank God.
Right. And we're spending a lot more to support the
economy. We're spending more, but you know, like, we're more than happy to import stuff, especially the goods. It's harder to import the services, and that's what needs to be made up now. But like, the world has plenty of unused capacity, right? So there's a lot going on that will be pushing down inflation. Now, on net, I think it could rise.
We're subsidizing the world too, right?
Yeah, I mean, they're happy about the relief package.
Our net exports going down month after month after month.
Yeah. So I think, you know, like, Buy USA has, you know, some features that are good. I do think we're going to see a big shift into services. I mean, you can only buy so many washing machines.
Yeah, there's going to be massages every week, right? Like,
So, awesome. And we can bring people classic back to work, and services can expand in a way. Like, we've seen this with gig work. Like, you don't have to be brick and mortar. You don't have, like, I just think there's so much more space. There's a lot of factors that ought to put downward pressure on inflation. But all that said, like, we are pumping out some money pretty fast, and right. people can't come back to work, you know, next week. So I don't know. So I see some, and I
a but little bit of inflation, not a spike, and transitory, sort of like, and that's what
yeah.
I was saying too.
Yeah. So, but you know, we could be wrong. But I mean, heck, they haven't seen 2% inflation for over a decade.
I know.
Right. Like Powell has said, you know, a little inflation would be right. kind of good. I mean,
their job a little easier.
Their dual mandate for a long time.
So thinking a little bit longer term for the next, you know, 3 or 4 years, mm-hmm. can I put you into one of these buckets? The Biden boost, Biden boom, or Biden bust?
So I'm a macroeconomist, so I am fundamentally a pessimistic person when I think about the economy. Now, as just a person, I'm like a 2/3 glass full, right? So this is always a tension for me. Like, okay. But you asked me about like kind of putting my forecaster hat on. I think the next 2 to 3 years are going to be a bumpy ride.
Okay.
I am a very apolitical person. I happen to work in spaces like inequality and full employment that do tend, like I do a lot more advising of Democratic members and staff, but I was raised Republican and I, you know, I would like talk to anybody, right? And I try to be very like not political in how I think about what's happening. But I do tell progressives, a lot of friends, my people are very smart on policy. I was just like, you need to be prepared to be disappointed. And I was saying this before the $15 minimum wage was pulled. I just think good intentions are not enough. Details really matter. And we're trying to do unprecedented policy changes. And I worked for a year at the Council of Economic Advisors. I interfaced, like I was a macro person. They didn't let me around the others very often because again, I'm pessimistic. I saw times where there was a reflection on policies that were already out there that were having some trouble. And like, it was really hard for them to accept that these great well-intentioned yeah. programs weren't working, right? And so that's a big problem. So I have, like, I think we're going to move in the right direction. I am very encouraged by this fiscal spending. I'm really encouraged about policymakers not expecting the Fed to do it alone, right? Like, yeah. this is bad. We're going to avoid a lot of scarring that, thanks to Stacey Abrams and the fine voters in Georgia,
yes.
like, we're taking a, you know, a real push at this. And yet, I think the building back better, getting to a place better than February, I mean, they have staked out, like, we want to fight climate change. We want to fight systemic racism. We want to bring inequality down. I mean, like, we haven't as a country ever been able to do this, right? So like, I don't care how many $1 trillion of government spending you do, this has to be a private sector, a global, like, this is a big deal. They are not going to succeed at this. But I mean, as I said before, like, swing for the fences and you might like get to second base, right? Yeah. Like, you know, so I think to me, that's what's going to happen. I don't expect a home run. I don't expect, I mean, in 3 years, if we have chipped away at any part of systemic racism, we should be like thrilled. But there are going to be a lot of people who will be disappointed because like we should have been making progress for like hundreds of years. Yeah. So I balance it out. So I'm probably at the lower end.
So maybe a Biden boost.
A Biden boost.
If I force it to use a literal.
Yeah, I mean, that's really where I would be. But I'm also the kind of person that I like to be surprised on the upside.
Yeah.
Like, one of my biggest frustrations last spring and summer, and a lot of this was coming from the administration, like Larry Kudlow, was to me, it was really talking up, like they were planning for the best, right? And right. I like to plan for the worst and hope for the best.
Yeah, and I think as a policymaker, that's an essential.
Yeah, it's a very, like, I was at the Fed for 10 years. I learned something, you know, yeah. like this is, and so like, I have a lot of reservations about what the policies are going to look like on the ground. And yet we are going to have a policy discussion that has been absent from DC in a long time. And I've seen Democrats get behind things like direct cash transfers that like weren't even in their vocabulary. Yeah, a bunch
of Republicans voted for direct trash transfers too, at least.
Yeah, so this is, it's just like with the Fed, when things change to people outside of Washington, D.C., that would much rather ignore the Fed and Congress and the administration, like changes that look small from the outside, like some of what's happening is really big.
Right.
So we'll see.
Okay, I guess I'm a little bit more optimistic than you. And I think there's going to be, giving a lot of money to the sort of lower quartile of the working force is going to pay off big. Mm-hmm. But I guess we will see in the next couple of years.
And just to be real quick, growth, like what a lot of these policies are trying to do, the ones we're going to start seeing, especially in this year and hopefully next year, they're going to raise long run growth. Like the year after year growth.
Right.
That is really,
that's powerful.
A quarter percentage point on income growth over years and years is huge. But when you see the number, you're like, it's 2/10 higher than last year. Is this really that good? Right. Like hard to see it, and you need the compounding, and you don't get compounding in a year. Right. So I think we'll see it. And these investments in people, like investments in children, like they are so going to pay off, but we're not going to see the payoff for years.
Yeah, I agree with that. But I am hoping that we're going to see something on the ground soonish. Well, thanks very much, Claudia. This has been a real pleasure. I hope we can have you on the show again.
Yeah, no, thank you for having me on. This was a great conversation.
In the meantime, if those people out there listening would like more information, they can check out our website, astorim.com. That's astorinvestmentmanagement.com. You can search for the Astor Research app at your favorite app store. In the meantime, tell a friend about the podcast, and we'll see you next week. Bye.